Well, I think in the interest of time, we will go ahead and get started. Again, this is Mitchell Warren from AVAC, and really want to welcome all of you wherever you are, sometimes early morning on the West Coast through to afternoon and evening in other parts of the world to this call to hear very early on the results as we know them from the HVTN-505 AIDS vaccine trial. We are going to have this call on global mute to keep the line clear for the presentations, but we most of all certainly want questions and comments to come. Throughout the call, if you do have questions, there are a number of ways to do it. If you are following along on the web watching the slides, there's a chat feature and you can enter your questions in there. You can always email them to avac@avac.org and we'll compile them as we go and I'll do my best to answer or to ask. I won't answer any, but I'll certainly try to ask the questions to our terrific resource people. And then we're happy most of all to have questions from people on the line, and you'll be able to hit *7 after the presentations to ask the question. And I would ask that you identify yourself and let us know where you're calling from. And then do hit *6 to put yourself back on mute again to keep the line clear. I really appreciate that. I really appreciate people joining this call on relative short notice, but nothing about HIV prevention research and certainly nothing about vaccine research has ever been easy or simple, and a lot of what you're going to hear right now is really information unfolding in somewhat real time, and that the investigating team has very graciously agreed to share with advocates to help all of us understand what these results mean. While nothing has ever been easy or simple about vaccine research, I have to say that in the midst of these results, the dedication of certainly the participants in any and all trials, and particularly HVTN-505, and the leadership from the trial investigators and the Vaccine Trials Network has really been remarkable to watch unfold, and really grateful that many of them are on the line today to help us all get our heads around this new information. Scott Hammer from Columbia University in New York has been the principal investigator, along with Magda Sobieczna, also at Columbia, and they have just been remarkable leaders of this trial from its earliest days in design to through the last few days and weeks as the information has come out. And I'm really grateful for them to be on the call. I'm going to turn it over to them in just a minute to introduce the overall conversation, and then Holly James, a statistician with the HIV Vaccine Trials Network at the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center in Seattle, I believe, is going to take us through the data as is available now. If you need any assistance, the slides are on the ReadyTalk interface. If you're having any trouble, feel free to send emails to avac@avac.org, and we'll do our best to connect. And again, we'll take questions throughout the presentations through the chat feature and via email at avac@avac.org, and then we'll open up the phone lines later. But with that, let me turn it over to Scott Hammer to start.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
So I'm here with Magda Sobieczek, and I think that first of all, we want to thank you for organizing this call. As you've done previously, we're always happy to and eager to speak with the advocacy groups of and key opinion leaders. This has been a long haul for 505, and I think that you said it beautifully. The thanks go not to us, but to the volunteers and their altruism and to the work at the sites to get this done. And the data that you probably have heard about through the NIAID press statement last week or through other channels are clearly disappointing, but that we got a clear and definitive answer to this trial, which we will hear about. And we learned from each clinical trial. We would have preferred a positive result, but what we have is a clear, definitive answer. But additional other questions are raised by these data, as they always are. We're happy to entertain questions. I think that's what we want the majority of this hour to be. I just ask Magda if she has any comments, and then we'd like to turn it over to Holly James to present the slides.
Thanks, Scott. No, no additional comment other than just to sort of add to the appreciation, and thanks for the opportunity to be on the call. All of us are really very grateful. Thank you.
Okay. Great. So with that, Holly, take it away.
Thanks. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so Mitchell, you'll advance the slides for me. That would be great. Thanks. So the data contained in this report summarize the data that we have to date, although some of these slides are still being updated to the most current data, and you'll see at full group meeting, for those of you who are attending, the full update of these slides to most current data. So just to remind us on this first slide here of the study design of 505, you'll recall that the study was expanded recently to include a total of 2,500 healthy HIV uninfected, AD5 seronegative circumcised men and male to female transgender persons who have sex with men. They were randomized to vaccine or placebo with equal probability and followed for 24 months post-enrollment. And there were two co-primary endpoints to the study. We evaluated the impact of vaccination on the rate of HIV acquisition and on set point viral load, which I will define in a moment. And the primary infection endpoints for the study we called week 28 plus infection events, because these were defined as participants who were diagnosed with HIV infection on or after day 196 post-enrollment through their month 24 visit. So moving to the next slide, the co-primary objectives of the study were firstly to assess the effect of vaccine on HIV acquisition, and this was measured by what we call the vaccine efficacy parameter, which measures the percent reduction in the rate of HIV infection in the vaccine versus placebo group, that considering infections that occurred between day 196 and month 24. And the second objective was to assess the vaccine effect on set point viral load, which is measured by the mean difference, placebo minus vaccine, of the set point viral load endpoint among participants who became infected after week 28. And the set point viral load measurement was calculated for each participant who became HIV infected as an average of all available pre-antiretroviral therapy viral load values measured at weeks 10 to 20 post-infection diagnosis. So moving to the next slide. This is a snapshot of the study data as of this current as of April 22nd, last week. And we can see that of the total 2,504 participants that were ultimately enrolled in the study, at this time point, 10.5% remained in the vaccination phase, although, of course, vaccinations have been stopped at this point in time. An additional 46% of participants had completed their vaccinations but were continuing to be followed for the 24 months of follow-up. 35% of participants had completed their 24 months of follow-up, and 8% of participants had terminated the study early. So what we look at in this sort of summary is to ensure that the distribution of study status is well-balanced between the two treatment arms, which indeed we see that it is, with the exception of a slightly higher early termination rate in the placebo arm as compared to the vaccine arm, a 9.4% dropout rate versus 7.3% in the vaccine arm. And we can see that at this point in time, the median duration of follow-up per participant was about 15 months. Moving to the next slide. This slide gives us a brief summary of the baseline participant characteristics, and the important point here, although there's not much data shown, is that these characteristics were very well balanced between the two treatment arms, which is what we like to see and what we, of course, expect to see in a randomized study. Specifically, the participant characteristics, demographics, age, race, and so on, very well balanced between the two treatment arms. And in addition, the self-reported risk behaviors at baseline and a behavioral risk score that we derived were also very well balanced between the two treatment arms. We can see in this slide here a summary of the distribution of that behavioral risk score in the placebo group and in the vaccine group, where individuals were, we calculated a score for these individuals by fitting a model to predict HIV infection risk over the course of the study and searched for behavioral risk variables that were maximally predictive of HIV infection risk. And through that procedure, we identified two variables that were maximally predictive of risk, number of male partners being greater than three, and unprotective receptive anal sex. Based on those two variables, we can calculate the score for each participant, and they fall into one of four categories, as shown on this slide, low, low to medium, medium to high risk, and high risk. And we see that the proportions of participants falling into each of those categories are very similar in the vaccine and placebo groups, with about 20% of participants being at highest risk of HIV infection according to this risk score. So moving to the next slide. So there were a series of data safety monitoring board meetings over the course of the study, but there was only one interim analysis of efficacy futility that was conducted. There were a planned three such analyses, but at the first analysis, the DSMB recommended the trial the vaccinations be stopped for efficacy futility. And that first interim analysis of efficacy futility was last Monday. And at that point in time, there were 2,494 participants who we call in the modified intent to treat population. This means that they were deemed to be HIV uninfected at baseline. 1,244 of those participants were on the placebo arm and 1,250 on the vaccine arm. And at that point in time, we had a median duration of follow-up on those participants of about 15 months. And to give you a sense of how far we were through the study at that point in time, about 64% of the possible participant follow-up time had been completed. So what we see on this slide is the number of HIV infections that had been observed by that point in time in the study. The primary infection endpoints for the study are called week 28 plus infections, of which there were 48 at that point in time, 21 on the placebo arm and 27 on the vaccine arm. Also shown in this table is the number of infections that were diagnosed before week 28, 9 on the placebo arm and 14 on the vaccine arm, and the total number of infections in the modified intent to treat or MITT population, 71, 30 on the placebo arm and 41 on the vaccine arm. So again, the primary analyses, the results of which I'll show in a moment, include only the week 28 plus infection events, but of course in secondary analyses we have evaluated all HIV infections as well. So moving to the next slide. This is a key slide showing us the cumulative probability of week 28 plus HIV infection at the time of the interim analysis, where we see the data for the placebo group in black and the vaccine group in red. And we see the annual incidence of HIV, of week 28 plus HIV infection, was estimated as 2.3% annually in the placebo arm and 3.1% annually in the vaccine arm. And looking at the curves, we see that the cumulative probability of HIV infection was quite similar between the two arms over most of the follow-up period. And then at around month 21 of follow-up, there was an uptick in the infection rate in the vaccine arm due to a few additional infections on that arm. Moving to the next slide, slide 8. Here we see the estimates of vaccine efficacy for preventing week 28 plus HIV infection. So we estimated that the hazard ratio for HIV infection comparing vaccine to placebo was 1.25, which corresponds to an estimated vaccine efficacy of minus 25% and a confidence interval ranging from minus 120 to 29%. Importantly, a p-value of 0.45, far away from statistically significant. We examined a variety of other alternative analysis methods, statistical analysis methods, which produced nearly identical results. So the take-home point from this analysis is that there was no evidence, no significant impact of vaccination on the rate of HIV infection, no significant difference in the rate of infection between vaccine and placebo groups. Moving to slide 9, looking at the set point viral load endpoint at the interim analysis, of the 48 week 28 plus infected subjects, 37 of those subjects were included in the analysis of set point viral load, where participants were included in this analysis if we had all the data we would ever get on them for set point viral load, or we had sufficient data to impute their missing endpoints. And of the 37 participants that were included, 30 of those participants had observed set point viral load endpoints. 14% of participants were missing those endpoints due to ART initiation before week 10 post-infection diagnosis, and 5% were missing endpoints due to having dropped out before week 10. And importantly, the total 19% of participants who were missing those endpoints is highly consistent with what was assumed in the protocol at the design stage, which was a 20% rate of missingness. So moving to slide 10, this slide shows us the distribution of that set point viral load endpoint in the placebo group on the left and the vaccine group on the right. The individual points are set point viral load measurements for individual participants who were diagnosed with week 28 plus infection. And the colored horizontal lines show us the point estimates for the mean set point viral load in each treatment group. And the blue and the green lines show us different estimates depending on which statistical analysis method we use, where I'll focus on the green method, which is our primary analysis method. And the vertical dashed lines show us the 95% confidence intervals around those estimated means. So what we see, looking again at those green lines, is that the mean set point viral load in the placebo group was very similar to the mean set point viral load in the vaccine group. So very little evidence of any meaningful differences in the mean set point viral load between the two treatment groups. And we can see on the next slide the point estimates for the difference in means, which we denote by delta viral load. The difference in means between the two treatment groups was estimated as 0.06. With a confidence interval ranging from minus 0.53 to 0.95, and a p-value of 0.884. So, again, we employed alternative statistical analysis techniques that produced very similar results, and the take-home point from this analysis as well was that there was no significant impact of vaccination on set point viral load. Moving to the next slide. So at the time of this interim analysis, the conclusions that were drawn on the basis of this efficacy futility analysis was that the formal non-efficacy boundary had been crossed because that boundary required comparing the confidence intervals for the vaccine efficacy estimate and for the delta viral load estimate to the targets that were originally set out in the design of the study. And it was noted that the vaccine efficacy confidence interval had an upper limit of 29%, which was well below the targeted efficacy for this vaccine of 50% efficacy. And in terms of delta viral load, the upper limit of that 95% confidence interval was 0.95, which lays just below the original targeted impact of vaccination of 1 log reduction in set point viral load. And importantly, all the p-values for comparing vaccine and placebo groups were above 0.4, so there was no evidence of any significant differences between treatment groups, either with respect to the rate of HIV infection or with respect to the mean set point viral load. So formally, the study had crossed the non-efficacy futility boundary. And we also augmented these calculations augmented these analyses with conditional power calculations. So these are simply calculating the probability that at the end of the study, one would find a significant benefit of vaccination given the data that had accrued to that point in time. And the result of those calculations was that conditional power was very low. It would be very unlikely, given the data we had seen to that point in time, that we would end up concluding that the vaccine was having a benefit at the end of the study. So moving to the next slide, I'll briefly summarize additional very important data that was provided in terms of safety. There was an observation of a significantly higher rate of reactogenicity in the vaccine arm, but importantly, the vast majority of these reactogenicity events were mild or moderate in severity. Severe events were very rare, occurring in less than 2% of participants for local reactogenicity and less than 3% for systemic reactogenicity. And the rates of adverse events were very similar between the two treatment arms. There were 6 deaths over the course of the study, all of which occurred on the placebo arm. And again, reiterating the point that there were no significant differences in the rate of HIV infection between the vaccine and placebo arms. So overall, the data supported the safety of the vaccine. And moving to slide 14, the data also supported the conclusion that the study was conducted with very high quality. 94% of participants followed through the month 6 visit were fully vaccinated, and 92% of the primary infection endpoints, the primary infections occurring among participants diagnosed with week 28 plus infection, 92% of those participants were fully vaccinated. There were high visit attendance rates during the primary follow-up period, 91 to 100% over months 0 to 6, and 82 to 90% over months 7 to 24. The study dropout rate, importantly, was at 5.9%, which was well below the pretrial assumption of a 10% annual dropout rate. I noted earlier there was a slightly higher rate of dropout on the placebo arm versus the vaccine arm, but again, this difference is very small. Self-reported PrEP and PEP use was rare over the course of about 3.2% of participants reported such usage at any point in time over the study, which improves our ability to conclude that what we're observing here is a vaccine effect, and not complicated by PrEP use by substantial PrEP use among trial participants. And there were moderately high post-infection visit attendance rates, averaging 81 to 86% for week 28 plus infections over the key weeks 10 to 20 post-infection diagnosis. Okay, so that's a brief summary of the data, and I'd be happy to take any questions, and Peter would also join as well, I think, in a few moments and help out with those as well.
Great. Holly, thank you so very, very much. That was a terrific and speedy summary of the data. Scott and Magda, before we open it up for questions, any additional comments or perspectives from you?
I'll turn it over to Magda in a moment. I just want to mention a couple of things first. Thanks to Holly for a very clear presentation. And then just to remind the group that Magda and I first heard about this information at the DSMB meeting on the 22nd of April, just 8 days ago. And we immediately moved to discontinue vaccinations, and nobody was vaccinated on Tuesday. We also immediately decided that we would unblind the population so that they would know and be able to be counseled about whether they got vaccine or placebo and make the best decisions for their future. We are our own, as well as a recommendation from a suggestion from the DSMB, planning to revise the protocol to follow people more closely than for every 3 months going into year 3. Let me just remind the group that our close follow-up period is through month 24. Participants are followed for 5 years, but in years 3, 4, and 5, it's really a touch base with the site and no requirement except are you okay and what's happened in the interval once a year. We're going to recommend changing that, and if our participants are willing, have efficient and helpful continued follow-up every 3 months, at least through years 3 and 4, and amend the protocol that way so that we can continue risk reduction counseling, behavior questionnaire information, which is crucial, and HIV testing, both for the vaccine and placebo groups. And I will stop there. I just want people to know that we're thinking about the participant safety and the ongoing close look at them to make sure we get more longitudinal information on HIV infection rates over time, although it will be in an unblinded population, which has some statistical biases to it. We want to try to make it attractive for both placebo and vaccine recipients to stay in close touch with their study sites so we do not have the bias of differential dropout. And also, not done yet, but we're having meetings about it. We've had meetings about it, and now we'll focus even more with more intensity on what the laboratory parameters are going to be, immunogenicity, numbers, assays, viral sequencing, et cetera, to help explain on the scientific laboratory side what went on in this trial. Magda?
Thanks, Scott. No, nothing to add. Just looking forward to questions.
Great. Thank you both so much. And on that note, we've already had some emails coming in through the ReadyTalk chat function, and feel free to keep posting them there. You could also email to avac@avac.org at any point, or you can hit *7 to unmute your line and ask a question. We would ask that you put it back on hold with put it back on mute with *6, and, of course, introduce yourself. Perhaps I'll start. There were a couple of that did come in for some clarification on some terms and on some of the data. One, and I know it's something that a lot of people have asked about, this 28-plus week description of the infections. And someone's asked, you know, can you clarify why the 28-plus week cutoff?
Ellie, do you want us to, I can take a stab at it first.
Sure.
I think in clinical trial design, you hear the term randomized and intention to treat. And those two terms are very important to eliminate bias in the selection of participants to enroll and in what arm they get randomized to. And so as Holly mentioned, this was both randomized and the analysis was done as an intention to treat. The reason that we specified for the week, for the primary analysis, people who got infected on day 196 or week 28 at that point through the end of the study was to be sure that we gave the vaccine the time for each participant to get the full vaccination regimen. There were three DNA vaccine injections and by bioinjector and one needle and syringe boost of an Ad5 vector multi-clade multi-gene at month 6. Then at month 7, which is approximately, obviously, week 28, was the primary immunogenicity visit. So the week 28-plus infections maintains the intent to treat because it didn't require for the analysis that everybody get all the injections, but it gave the time to do that. And it gave not only the time to get the fourth injection at month 6, but to develop an immune response to that injection. And so we were trying to give the vaccine the best chance of working. For example, if in the infection analysis for it starts on enrollment, you might say if somebody got infected 2 weeks after the first DNA vaccination, that's important, but how do you know that the vaccine, you didn't even give the vaccine a chance to work? So this gave the vaccine a chance to work as far as inducing an immunogenicity response while still maintaining that blind to intent to treat and maintain the essence and integrity of the randomization. I hope I've answered the question, but Holly and Peter can amplify.
Scott, this is Holly. I'll just add that, as Scott mentioned, so the hypothesis was that if one restricted attention to infections that occurred after the vaccination series had, you know, taken time to take place, one would, give the vaccine the best shot. And so that would be the type of infections or the timing of infections where we would see an impact of vaccination. So we've looked at that as the primary analysis. But as I mentioned, in secondary analyses, we've also examined all infections that occurred post-baseline. And in that analysis, we also do not see any significant impact of vaccination. So the week 28 plus analysis was primary, but we've also looked at the set of all infections occurring after baseline.
Great. And just to be clear and just to confirm both with Holly and Scott, when you talk about the primary analysis, all of that was pre-specified in the protocol. So, you know, I know in some of the past trials there's been a lot of post hoc analysis. This is all still the primary analysis as described by the protocol, correct?
That's correct. We have a fairly lengthy, you know, probably 100-page document describing and laying out and pre-specifying all the statistical analyses that were used for this trial.
Great. And we have a couple of questions about, and Holly, you presented some of the data on reactogenicity. One was just a basic point about, can you just define what that is and what it signals. But related, someone else had asked about the reactogenicity rates and noted that at least what you presented looked at the severe events, and a question about the differential dropout and the increase in the placebo arm. Someone asked if there was possibly reactogenicity, if there were different overall reactogenicity levels that weren't just about the severe events that might have influenced the dropout.
Right, so maybe I can say a little bit about the data, and Scott can expand on what reactogenicity means more in medical terms. But in terms of reactogenicity, so we've compared reactogenicity rates between the two treatment arms, and as would be expected with a vaccine of this type, there are significantly increased rates of reactogenicity in the vaccine versus placebo arms. However, the events that are severe or greater are quite rare. So that was the take-home message of those analyses. And the question about a hypothesis as to whether or not reactogenicity could be related to dropout, we've looked at that, and there really doesn't appear to be any significant evidence that's true, although I think more investigation is needed. Importantly, however, the rate of dropout was low enough in this study that that our sense is that even if reactogenicity was driving some amount of dropout, it wouldn't have created a meaningful bias in the estimate of vaccine efficacy.
So this is – thanks, Holly. This is Magda, and I can add just a little bit more about the reactogenicity and how it's measured in this study. So as you can imagine, when we vaccinate individuals, we're interested not only in seeing what the vaccine does to their immune system, how it stimulates the white cells and what sort of responses it produces, and then, of course, what it does to the rates of HIV infection, et cetera. But we're also very interested in seeing what type of, sort of immediately after vaccination, what type of symptoms and signs our participants report, and those are things such as fever, pain at the, you know, at the site of the injection, any redness, any swelling, any headaches, kind of these sort of systemic signs that people oftentimes get even after the flu shot. They report kind of some mild symptoms. So all of that information is very important to collect as we prepare data about the safety and kind of signs and symptoms seen with administration of every vaccine. And so on a day after, sort of right after a vaccine is administered, we monitor and we observe participants in the clinic, and we ask them about these, you know, signs and symptoms. Are you having any fever? You know, what is your temperature? What is your any pain and tenderness at the site or these other things that I mentioned? And then also participants are asked about these signs and symptoms over the week, sort of the week following the injection. And all of that data is collected and fed to SHARP, and it's presented as Holly presented it in terms of, you know, sort of comparing whether participants with the vaccine experienced more headaches, more fevers, and more of these other signs and symptoms than individuals who got the placebo. Scott, anything else to add? Or?
No, I just would echo what Holly said about we do try to capture the reasons for people to discontinue at any point in the trial, and we had very few that did it for reasons of side effects of the vaccine. And in addition to the local and systemic reactogenicity, we also monitor, obviously, for other adverse events, which can be anything that goes on and decide whether it's related or not related to the vaccine. So those data were not presented, but were reviewed carefully by the DSMB.
Great. Thank you all. Well, we've had a number of questions that have come in related to PrEP and PEP use. Maybe I'll just tell you what the three are so far and let you respond to them in some combination. The first was that it sounded from the slide that Holly presented that it was self-reported PrEP and PEP use, and a question of will you also have data related to actual biologic testing of samples to see if people actually were using it either to a greater or lesser degree. Secondly, were there any seroconversions for those who reported PrEP or PEP? And that may depend on, of course, the answer to the first question. And then the third question came from someone else on the line who asks, what is the likelihood that the HVTN, for those who don't know, the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, might work with the HPTN, the Prevention Trials Network, so that 505 participants might be able to enroll in the HPTN-069 study or the next PrEP study, looking at different PrEP regimens, and given that currently co-enrollment's not allowed, but wondering if these participants might be able to roll over into this other study. So I'll leave those for the team to answer related to PrEP and PEP use.
Thanks, Mitchell. So maybe let me start, and maybe I'll turn it over to Holly for the seroconversion question, even though I suspect we may not have much data on that. But the question about the self-reported use and whether or not we have looked at the data, sort of more objective data, let's say, on whether participants were actually using PEP and PrEP, and that would be by checking blood levels for the drug. So we do have samples that were being collected at study visits with the intention of analyzing and checking for drug levels. That has not been done yet. Those samples are stored, but there is definitely an interest in looking at this more objective measure of PEP and PrEP use, so that's something that's pending. And Holly, about the question about sort of whether there are any seroconversions in participants or on PEP and PrEP, if you wanted to expand on that.
Yeah, so I don't. We have not lined up the PrEP and PEP data with HIV infection status at this point. I doubt that there would be any more than one or two infections among the PrEP users, given the very rare rate of usage. But we need to take a look at that.
So with respect to the HPTN question, which is a very pertinent question, we are certainly very much open to that. I think what we want to do is, as I said, try to retain people for a follow-up and make it easy for them, but also make sure people have access to whatever measures to help protect themselves that they wish to, including enrolling in other studies. So I don't think we will have as we modify the protocol, restrictions on at all on persons doing what they feel is best for them. That placebo recipients can go into will be able to go into another vaccine trial if they wish, although there is not another efficacy trial on the horizon, immediate horizon in the U.S. But they can choose to go into other things. And as far as those who receive vaccine, I think it will depend on the particular protocol, whether it excludes people who had or have participated in a vaccine trial. But the bottom line answer is that we want to empower individuals and inform them about access to PrEP if that's what they would like to do, general risk reduction counseling, and other opportunities across networks. So we hope to really impart that knowledge and let people make knowledgeable decisions.
Great. Thanks, all. A couple of questions related to the endpoints and treatment. So maybe I'll focus on those. And again, for those on the line, you can email, as a lot of people are doing, or use the chat function. And I think after this set of questions, perhaps I'll open it up for anyone to ask live. But a question, the data that Holly, you presented looked at the post-28-week infections, and a question here about any pre-week 28 infections, if that's available. And then another participant asked, given the current, at least in the U.S. where 505 took place, guidelines recommend initiation of ART irrespective of CD4 count, do you have information about when people initiated treatment who were in the trial and seroconverted, and is that different than what you might have expected, given that the guidelines and recommendations have changed since the trial was first designed, and the viral load endpoint was originally the primary analysis. So I'll leave it to you all to decide who's going to answer those questions.
So, Scott, maybe I can speak to the post-infection data and let you follow up with on that. So with regard to looking at post-infection data on the participants who became infected before week 28, so yes, we have looked at the set point viral load data as well as ART initiation data in that set of participants, although as we tend to look at it as considering all week 28 plus infections and then considering all infections as a set. What we call that is the set of infections that occurred in the modified intent to treat population. So when we look at all infections that occurred in the modified intent to treat population, we again see no significant difference in mean set point viral load between the two treatment groups. And in terms of ART initiation, we do of course collect data on that. We estimated that the probability of ART initiation by week 10 post-infection diagnosis was about 18% among the primary infection endpoints and about 28% by initiated ART by week 20 post-infection diagnosis. So I'll let Scott speak to whether or not those are higher or lower than what would have been expected at the design stage.
So I think as the protocol evolved, as guidelines changed, we recognized that the viral load set point endpoint was potentially in jeopardy if everybody went on early ART. There were estimates in the protocol that at least 20% of the viral load set point endpoints might be censored. That means people might start ART in the first 10 weeks post-diagnosis, so we would not have the viral load set point as defined by weeks 10 to 20. And we did a few things on that basis. One is, if we just had one value at week 10 and then people went on ART on week 11 or week 12, we still used that value and there was an imputation or a calculation of what that viral load would have looked like compared to those who actually had five specimens drawn between weeks 10 and 20. As it turned out, we had enough infections and to look at that analysis, although that's why the number is smaller than the first vaccine efficacy analysis. We also knew we were prepared to look at just the first viral loads. If, let's say, for argument's sake, everybody went on ART within 4 weeks of diagnosis, then our primary endpoint would not have been calculable as far as viral load set point, and we would have looked at whatever available viral loads we had. But as it turned out, we had enough to analyze to actually fulfill the criteria of being able to answer the viral load set point question. But I think the thrust of the question by itself is important. Viral load set point in converters in the United States and in resource-rich areas is less of a question for vaccine because we're treating people early. And that's one of the reasons this protocol expanded to make viral acquisition, HIV acquisition, the co-primary and really most important endpoint for efficacy.
Great. Thanks, Scott. I think it is really important, and many on the line know that this is a protocol that has evolved many times over a number of years, and things that are happening in 2013, largely unpredictable, and some of the earliest discussions of this protocol many years ago. So really, really helpful, Scott. A number of additional questions, really great questions, have come in both email and on the chat function, but perhaps I'll pause and see if anyone has a question on the line. You can hit star 7 to unmute. I would ask that you introduce yourself and before you ask. Okay. I'll wait one more moment. Star 7 to unmute. All right, not a problem. Keep them coming because these are terrific questions. Another question came up related to a slide toward the beginning about participant risk levels, and the question whether this was before they entered the study, at enrollment, and if this data was measured again in the trial to see about changes in this participant risk level categorization.
Yeah, thanks, Mitchell. So, yes, to clarify, the data that I discussed on slide 5 was behavioral risk information collected at enrollment using an ACOSI questionnaire that queried about risk behavior over the previous 3 months. So it was risk behavior as reported at enrollment. We, of course, do collect that information throughout the study, but we have not yet looked at the longitudinal data on risk behavior. That's a key data set that is sort of next in line for us to look at and hopefully will be presented at full group meeting.
Great. Thanks, Holly. Two quick reminders to people. One, you've heard a couple of mentions about the full group meeting. This is the NIH-funded HIV Vaccine Trials Network meeting that it coincidentally is next week in Washington, D.C. As you just heard from Holly, this data will be presented there, and I think it's safe to say there'll be many discussions about this. From an AVAC perspective, we'll do our best to be watching and listening and conveying to advocates and partners about what additionally gets presented there. So stay tuned for more information as it unfolds. And the other piece, just as a reminder to everybody that perhaps is obvious, everything you've seen presented here, the data, the slides, is really unfolding in real time. And there's a lot, probably far more that is not yet known to anyone about the data, given that this really was just being analyzed over the last week or so, and that the recommendation from the DSMB came just last Monday. And this is all unfolded in an incredibly short time frame. So the fact that we're able to see this much data presented to all of us from the team is really remarkable, and know that many of these questions that are not yet answerable are that the data just there just hasn't been enough time in the day to analyze it all, and really want to thank Holly and all of you on the data side for that, and just to be really clear about why there's a lot of additional question marks. Again, let me just pause for star 7 if there are any questions from the line. All right. A couple of additional questions about the follow-up, and I think, Scott, you described the ongoing follow-up to continue certainly with the trial. But a question with these results about people who've already been lost to follow-up as reported here. Are there going to be additional efforts through the network generally and the site PIs to try to locate any and all of those individuals who've been missing from past visits?
Thank you, Mitchell. Let me start answering first, and then Scott can add. So that's it's a key question, and actually, I should say that retention has been an important focus for the team and for the sites over the past 6 months or so, when we really sort of reinvigorated a lot of efforts to try to make sure that we can follow participants and locate those who've been missing for a variety of reasons. So there's already been a lot of work done by the sites and with CORE's help to try to enhance retention and augment it. And I completely agree that as part of this follow-up, the team and HPTN feel very strongly that that's going to be an important, will continue to be an important focus. And actually, at the full group meeting, we'll have conversations and discussions with the sites and staff and HPTN on sort of coming up, developing, reviewing strategies, developing new strategies to make sure that we retain not only participants who are on study, but those who may have been missing for a variety of reasons. Scott, anything to add?
I have nothing to add except that, of course, all of this is voluntary on the participants' part, but we will reach out to everyone.
Great. Thanks for that. Another question came in, and a term that I know a lot of people are very familiar with in the vaccine community. Some of on the line may be less so. But someone asked about the vaccine-induced seropositivity, or the term sometimes called VISP. And it's a term that people are, or an issue that people have been concerned about in terms of the vaccine recipients who need to be tested through the clinical trial to know what is actually an HIV infection and what might be vaccine-induced seropositivity but not an infection. And a question about for how long might you estimate the trial participants might experience this vaccine-induced seropositivity, if they experience it at all, and what might happen over the next couple of years as we try to understand that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So that's a very important one, and one that we spend a lot of time counseling our participants about. So, you know, there's been a substantial amount of data collected and analyzed about the phenomenon of vaccine-induced seropositivity in the current and vaccine trials that have been conducted to date, and there was a paper published, I think, about a year ago or so by the HVTN that sort of describes what is the occurrence or prevalence, or how frequently do we see vaccine-induced seropositivity with the vaccines that have been used to date, or DNA vaccines or adenovirus-based vaccines, and for how long it persists. And I should mention that, you know, this is also sort of another example of kind of live and real-time accumulating data that hasn't been that long that we've had we're collecting this data about the persistence of and how long does vaccine-induced seropositivity last. We're monitoring participants closely in on protocol and in kind of longitudinal long-term follow-up protocols. And it's only been sort of for a certain amount of time that we've had vaccines that were capable of producing this phenomenon of vaccine-induced seropositivity. So there's still a lot of questions that are remaining about how long it persists. With this specific vaccine product, the DNA DNA Prime AT5 boost, we also don't have a whole lot of data about how long we can expect for vaccine-induced seropositivity to persist, but that is another reason why it will be important for us to follow our participants, those who got the vaccine in 505, and then also make available to them, there's another protocol, an observational protocol, through the HVTN that follows participants for even longer, even after the primary study has ended. And it sort of allows for HIV testing through the vaccine trials network and follows kind of, you know, the evolution and the trajectory of these false positive antibody responses that the person may have after they've received a vaccine. So it's, you know, just to highlight kind of very critically that the VTN is very much interested in this question, as is the entire field. And there are these very practical mechanisms that have been put in place to help us figure it out, but also to help participants as they kind of negotiate this issue. But let me kind of launch into the answer, but I think, Mitchell, do you think we should talk a little bit more about what vaccine-induced seroreactivity or seropositivity is, or...
You know what I was going to suggest, because I know we're running a little short on time, and actually I was just about to say when you finished there that for those who are interested, there was a meeting co-hosted by the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise and NIAID and the HVTN and a number of other partners looking at this issue. And in fact, for those interested, on Thursday, just in a couple of days, and I'm just checking the time, I believe it is at this very same time, 11 a.m. Eastern time, The Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise is hosting a web briefing on vaccine-induced seropositivity and the discussions at that meeting that took place just a month or so ago. So for those interested, and I know that the Enterprise will be posting a report about that as well. So for those interested, I think probably best in the interest of time that we leave that one there. I do, there are way more questions than we're going to have time for in the next 5 minutes, but I do want to turn to at least three if we have time. We'll make time. One, the 505 leadership under you both, Scott and Magda, really did focus over the last couple of years in real time in looking at pre-exposure prophylaxis, given the IPREX result and then subsequently the FDA approval just last year. And a question came in about how might you share that experience with other trialists about the evolving standard of prevention in trials? And just very briefly, what can other trials and sites learn from you all on this?
Thank you, Mitchell. So let me start answering that. I think, as you alluded to, this has been an incredibly valuable sort of experience for the entire protocol team as we experienced the IPREX results and all the information that was coming out about PrEP. And I should say that I think one of the lessons learned that we've started disseminating and hope to disseminate even more has been the incredible input we've received from individuals like you on the call today, from the stakeholders and community members and our participants and site staff, as we've kind of been negotiating about does the study and how should the vaccine field sort of evolve and respond to these other events in the prevention field. So I think the lessons that we've learned in how to communicate with our participants, how to communicate with each other, and how to communicate with advocacy members have been great, and we'll be very important for us to share it with others.
I would just add that there are a couple of approaches, and that we've explored all of them over the last few years. One is whether to incorporate PrEP into a protocol itself as a standard of care option, and to randomize people to PrEP plus or minus the experimental vaccine, or as we've done in 505, because of logistics and other things, we've started a referral system for PrEP, and we will continue that PrEP access program for our participants, even though the vaccination phase has stopped and the answer is in because of the follow-up. And I think the bottom line is that we want to maximally give people options to protect themselves with information, but the PrEP issue will be with us. We have issues of adherence in some other protocols, et cetera, but it's certainly a viable tool, and we will be exploring this more in the post-hoc, post-unblinded phase by giving people the option but following the information. So I think for the field, in the field that we've talked, at least the networks have talked with each other, and I think at meetings we've talked about this, and it's the issue of combination prevention, which is really everything we do is combination prevention, and what's the role of PrEP and microbicides as we move forward. But with PrEP is pretty special because it's been FDA approved, although the national uptake is hard to measure, but so far has been low. Although one might expect, prepared for this, that in a vaccine trial that did not work, that people might relook at PrEP who haven't looked at it before, and we might see an uptick in interest in the post-unblinded phase.
Great. And absolutely, Scott. And I have to both thank all of you involved in 505 for having really thought deeply over the years about this issue, and it really is potentially one of the very important elements going forward, as you say, in the follow-up phase to see if these results influence PrEP in a positive way, people looking at it differently and thinking that this might be an option for them, given that you have a fabulous cohort of 2,500 men who have sex with men and transgender women who really could benefit from PrEP if they choose. So I really, really appreciate that. I know we're at the top of the hour, a number of additional questions which we've not had time for. I encourage people to continue to send those in. We will be in touch with Scott and Magda and the HVTN. But I do want to make sure, because there's a two questions that came in separately but very similar, and it's about the future. And for many of you, hopefully you all know, that just in a couple of weeks we have HIV Vaccine Awareness Day coming up, a day that has been around for almost 15 years now to commemorate and honor trial participants. And a couple of questions came in from advocates. How do you all think of the next steps, and how should we be talking to communities about vaccine research? And to follow on, when might the next efficacy study be implemented, and how do we continue to cultivate future participants and supporters of HIV vaccine research, knowing how important it is, but in the context of results that are disappointing? So I think a great set of questions that I'd love to have Holly, Peter, Magda, Scott, all of you, or any of you comment on.
So I'll take a stab at this. So I think the group might be aware, but I'll just remind everyone that the 505 was opened in first participant in June of 2009, and we enrolled our last participant on March 27th of 2013, and the DSMB gave us this news less than a month later. So we've been dealing with the present, I think, for the last 8 days, and not so much philosophically about the future, but when we do have those moments, we learn a lot from these efficacy trials. It teaches us a lot about the heroism and the altruism of our participants, the dedication of the site personnel, the community support, et cetera. And even though negative, there will be information from this trial, both in its the basic facts on the ground, the regimen, and the laboratory studies that we will pursue that will influence importantly design of future trials. The bottom line is we cannot give up on an HIV vaccine. The next series of efficacy trials are scheduled for Southern Africa as far as collaborative and HVTN plans are concerned. But I think that there are also some scientific issues that we will think about as far as what was not in this vaccine that should be in other vaccines, and what the recent technological advances are in the laboratory that will be moving into phase one for the future. But I think the issues are, this should be, it's another episode of the Sisyphus analogy. We've got to keep moving the stone up the hill until we have victory on this. The only way to really control HIV throughout the globe is ultimately through a safe and effective vaccine. So we have to learn from this and go on, however disappointed we are at the moment.
Great. Thanks, Scott. Magda, Holly, Peter, any additional comments or thoughts?
No. Sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Peter. I would just add, going back to what Scott said, that there's likely going to be some study of the viral sequences in infected volunteers, and there will be study of the immune responses induced by the vaccine, and maybe looking at some of the genetics of the participants like HLA and others. And I think through that investigation, we're hoping we can understand why the vaccine failed. And so that'll narrow down the set of candidates that are going to be promising for the next vaccine trial. So that's a very important outcome of these trials that show failed vaccines, is we'll learn what didn't work, hopefully get insight on why it didn't work, and then that'll help design better vaccines for the next trials.
Great. Thanks so much, Peter. This, for me, although the data is disappointing, the conduct of the study, the openness and transparency and honesty of the investigators, the focus on making sure 2,500 trial participants got this information first and foremost. And I think for me, most interestingly and excitingly, is to see some of the reactions from trial participants, many of whom were tweeting when they got this news that they would be in this trial again. And it is an amazing contribution of theirs to be in a clinical trial. I think some 505 participants are on the call right now. An amazing commitment to be in a trial at all, and then to look at these results and say, I'm glad I was in it and I would do it again. It's a great reminder as we do go into Vaccine Awareness Day of how critical everyone's role is, from statistician to PI to trial participant. I want to thank everyone for joining the call, and to Peter and Holly in Seattle for the data analysis in real time and presentation, and to Scott and Magda, to both of you, and to the entire team who made 505 happen. Thank you, and thank you for engaging in both helping advocates understand and listening to advocates going forward. We will, here at AVAC, we were already developing some materials for Vaccine Awareness Day and for AIDS vaccine outreach and education and advocacy anyway. Those materials are now being updated, also in real time based on this information, and we'll be making those available quite widely beginning hopefully next week. So stay tuned for those, and if there are particular questions or materials or resources you need to help you do your work better and more effectively and more informatively with this new information, please let us know, and we will certainly connect with the HVTN and many other partners to get accurate information out. You know, at the end of the day, the trial tells us that we need a vaccine. If you look at the incidence within the trial, it tells us that we need to be doing more with PrEP and other interventions that we have while we still have build this bridge eventually to a vaccine. So thank you all so very much again, Holly, Peter, Magda, and Scott especially for your time on the call. And we look forward to staying in touch as more information becomes available.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks all. Have a great
Thank you. Please stand by.